Hi everyone. It's a great pleasure to have Daniele Mescianzio visit us for a day and give a talk. So Daniele is a professor at UCSD, and he has done a lot of foundational work in lattice-based cryptography. One thing that I recently heard about Daniele from like Venki is that he says that Daniele seems to know something more about lattices than the rest of us. So today he will teach us more about lattices and the Gaussian sampling. So the title of his talk is Gaussian Sampling, Efficient, Generic, and Constant Time. Off to Daniele.
Thank you, Ranjit, for the introduction, and thanks everybody for coming, listening to me. So I'll be talking about algorithms to sample the Gaussian distribution over the integers, and specifically I'll describe an algorithm which is generic. It can be used in a wide range of applications and efficient. This joint work with my PhD student Michael Walter at UCSD, and the work will be presented at the Crypto conference next month in August. The work is already available as an print on the IACR website. So randomness is fundamental in cryptography. It is used to generate secret keys. It is used to encrypt messages so that an adversary that gets to see the same message encrypted twice cannot even detect that the two messages are equal. And the most common type of randomness, which is used in cryptographic functions, is the uniform distribution over a set. The typical example is the uniform distribution over a finite group, like the set of integers modulo p, as used in discrete log-based cryptography, or a uniformly random bit string, which can be used to key a block cipher or as a one-time pad to protect some message. And so lattice cryptography is somehow an exception in this respect. It needs randomness, which is not uniform, and therefore it is a little bit harder to generate. Now, lattices, they provide a motivation for what I'll be talking about today, but we will not really get to see lattices. I'm sorry if I'll disappoint you, but I can tell you everything you want about lattices over lunch if you like. So, but just to put this into context, lattice is a subgroup of Zn, is a group of vectors with integer coordinates. You can also define lattices more generally as discrete subgroups with real coordinates, but in cryptography, usually lattices have integer entries. And they can be used to build cryptographic functions. And most of the current interest in lattice cryptography has been driven by two factors. On one hand, lattices are believed to provide resistance against quantum computers. Now, quantum computers have not been built yet, but the research community is working actively to build them. Also, Microsoft is trying to build one, Google is trying to build one, governments are trying to build those computers. So there's a chance that sometime in the not too far future, there will be quantum computers capable of running a short algorithm to factor integers and break the type of cryptography which is in mainstream use these days, cryptography based on factoring or the discrete log problem. So there's a need to come up with some alternative. Lattice cryptography is one of the main alternatives out there. And there's also an ongoing standardization process started by NIST to address the need for such a crypto system. So the other attractive feature of lattices is that in the last decade, they have been proved to be extremely powerful and capable of delivering very complex and fancy cryptographic functions, starting from identity-based encryption, which is a type of public key encryption where you don't need to address the typical public key distribution problem, and you can use the people names or normal identities or email addresses as public keys. And one of the most powerful applications of lattices that brought really a lot of attention to this type of techniques is a fully homomorphic encryption, which is a type of encryption that allows to perform a computation on encrypted data without decrypting it. In fact, without even knowing the decryption key. And on the efficiency side, they can also be very attractive because the operations that are performed in lattice cryptography are, for the vast majority, simple arithmetic operations, like vector addition on vectors with small integer entries. So you don't even know long integer arithmetic. Most lattice cryptography can run on register-level integer arithmetic, and it is also very parallelizable because you have to perform many of these operations in parallel in an n-dimensional vector. Just to give you a sense of the dimension. The typical dimension used in lattice cryptography, n, the size of these vectors, is usually measured in the hundreds. However, sampling this non-uniform distribution is harder. And in fact, it's probably the hardest part in the implementation of lattice cryptography, both in terms of efficiency, runtime, and also in terms of implementation complexity. So it's something that requires a careful effort. Now, the distribution which is used in lattice cryptography is the discrete Gaussian distribution, which is defined as follows. So it is a distribution parameterized by two values, two real numbers, a center C and a width S. And so these two numbers define a Gaussian function. And you want to sample not a real number with Gaussian distribution, but an integer point. So take all the integer points, these blue points on this line, and you want to pick one of them with a probability which is proportional to the value of the Gaussian function computed at that point. So this is the formula. The probability of x should be proportional to e to the power minus x minus c over s squared. And you can see that so this c works just as a shift, is a translation, and s is a scaling factor. However, you cannot just generate a Gaussian sample and then apply a linear transformation to it, subtract c and s, because if you do so, then you end up with a value which is not an integer. So in order to sample this distribution, you need to know these values, C and S, in advance, and then based on those values, sample the corresponding distribution. It's not something that immediately reduces to sampling the normal distribution with zero mean, variance one, and then transforming it. So S, you can think of it as the width of this Gaussian function. And so this is a distribution over an infinite set of numbers. Which is also one of the reasons the uniform distribution is not applicable here. It's not even defined, the uniform one. And the distribution goes to zero very quickly. So in practice, you can also truncate this distribution. You can remove a negligible tail from the distribution and think of it as a distribution that is over a set of integers of size roughly order of s. So s times log n, where n is a security parameter. Josh?
As long as s is constant, can't you shift c by an integer?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. In fact, so if s is fixed, then you can shift s by an integer. But as this, so I put a line here, not because I couldn't center the point, because many applications require the Gaussian distribution centered around a non-integer point. But yes, when the center is an integer, then you can apply the shift after sampling your, you can sample something around zero and then apply an integer shift to it.
An integral shift should be possible, shouldn't it?
What's the difference between integer and integral?
No, oh, sorry, it's the same.
Yeah.
You can go from 1.2 to 2.2, right?
Yes. You can, yeah. You can shift it by an integer because that maps z to z, and that's fine. And truncating this distribution by removing the tails, that doesn't matter. Even if you're truncating it, then sure, it won't be exactly the same, but the difference is negligible, so it doesn't matter. Yep.
You can't sort of sample from a continuous Gaussian and round it to the
matrix? So you can sample from a continuous Gaussian distribution, which can be done using standard functions and techniques, assuming you have, say, floating point arithmetic, and then you can round the result. So if you do this, what you get, if you run it to the closest integer, you don't get this. You get a different distribution. So in order to get this one, you should first take that and then round it, do some form of randomized rounding that rounds your real Gaussian sample to an integer, but using essentially this, it is the same problem. The rounding problem is the same as the Gaussian discrete Gaussian sampling problem. And in fact, I will use that at the end. The last algorithm that I will present today can be used exactly in this fashion. Any other questions about the distribution?
You cannot just round to the nearest integer with different product. That won't.
If you do that, so if S is very, very large, you can do that, and it will be statistically close to what you want. But if S is not that large, and so S should be something that is. So in cryptography, you always use an S which is big enough so that if you take a real Gaussian sample and then you reduce it modulo 1, you get a uniform distribution over the 0-1 interval. But it is enough to have S to be something like 5 or 6 to get within statistical distance 2 to the minus 100 from the uniform distribution. So you can think of S as a parameter that can be as small as 5 or 6 in the best setting. And the arithmetic used in lattice cryptography usually is as a much larger modulus Q. So this is a distribution which is used to sample small values. So it's exactly what defines small in a technical sense in the learning with errors problem. Okay, so moving on. So this distribution is really central in lattice cryptography. It's a basic building block that is used almost everywhere. Sorry. So, the distribution. So learning with errors is one of the most fundamental problems used in lattice cryptography, and it consists of pairs that have a uniformly random vector A, modulo some integer Q, and then a value B, which is the scalar product between A and some secret vector Z. Now, if I give you many such pairs, then you can easily recover the secret Z by Gaussian elimination, by solving a linear system. So in the learning with error problems, in order to make this problem hard, an error term is added to B. So there is an integer perturbation which is added to it, and the distribution which is used to perturb this B term is the discrete Gaussian distribution. Yes?
It doesn't have the original LWE paper around it, Gaussian.
Yes, the original WE paper was using Gaussian and then rounding it, and there is a number of places where it is more convenient to use the discrete Gaussian one. So that's very true, and that makes proving hardness of the problem easier, so that a rounded Gaussian makes proving it easier, but then when it comes to building cryptographic functions out of it, implementing it, and do other things, then the discrete Gaussian is the distribution that is most convenient and more commonly used. So I guess the applications are more important than the proof of security, and that's how the discrete Gaussian became the standard way to define the problem now. So another class of problems where you need this, whether or not the LWE problem is proved hard using a rounded Gaussian or not, is the trapdoor preimage sampling problem. Now, in this problem, you want to sample the Gaussian distribution from an n-dimensional lattice. So you're in n-dimensional space, and you can reduce the n-dimensional sampling problem to n one-dimensional Gaussian sampling problems. You can sample it one coordinate at a time. And here it is very important to use the Gaussian distribution because here, I mean, Gaussian is opposed to uniform. The distinction between rounded Gaussian and discrete Gaussian is not that critical here. But it is important to use the Gaussian distribution because Gaussian distribution for every coordinate provides spherical symmetry. So the probability of a point that has independent Gaussian entries is a function of just the norm of the point. And so this is essential to protect a secret information. For example, a secret basis, which is known only to one user, you can use that basis to perform Gaussian rounding and Gaussian sampling. If instead of doing that, you round it using the uniform distribution, you end up with points that are distributed uniformly in a parallelepiped, and using PCA techniques, it is possible to quickly and efficiently recover the secret key. So the Gaussian distribution is here to stay. So I will use this notation, dGs, for the discrete Gaussian sampling problem and for the corresponding distribution, which is parametrized by the center C and the standard deviation S. Now, S here is not exactly the standard deviation. It's the up to scaling. It is the standard deviation. Cryptography paper for standard deviation, you would want a 1/2 factor here. Cryptography papers typically have a pi factor rather than 1/2 because that's the right factor to normalize some other quantity. But just for simplicity, I will not use those scaling factors here. Now, this problem is central to lattice cryptography. So not surprisingly, it has been the subject of many recent papers trying to come up with different algorithms or optimize the different algorithms to different settings to solve the Gaussian sampling problem. So these include the rejection sampling approach. Rejection sampling is a standard technique to sample distributions. I will sketch it in the next slide. And this is the method that was proposed by Gentry, Pikert, and Vaikuntanathan in 2008 when they first established the Gaussian distribution as a very useful distribution to realize a number of powerful cryptographic primitives, starting from digital signatures and identity-based encryption. And so the approach is fine, is asymptotically efficient, is elegant and nice, but when it comes to implementing cryptographic primitives, it easily proved to be one of the bottlenecks in the implementation. So there have been several follow-up works suggesting different methods to generate this Gaussian distribution over Z. One of them is the inversion sampling technique, another standard technique which was proposed to be used in the context of lattice cryptography by Pikert in 2010. There's a discrete ziggurat is another optimized algorithm. It's the discrete version of the standard ziggurat algorithm to sample the continuous distribution that first approximates the Gaussian function with a set of steps, and then it improves somehow the rejection probability by using this shape. There's a Bernoulli type algorithm that it uses a particular setting of parameters that allows to reduce the problem to the choice of a number of Bernoulli random variables. Now, Knut Yao, this is an approach to sample arbitrary distribution which was first used in the context of lattice cryptography in 2014. It's one of the fastest methods out there. And one more method which has received very little attention in cryptography so far, but in our experimental evaluation proved to be very, very good, and so it is certainly worth a look, is a method of Carney that is based on a trick of von Neumann to sample the Gaussian distribution exactly. It also works for the discrete one. It is a very nice and elegant approach to sample the distribution. There are many other works, especially tied to specific applications, where the Gaussian sampling algorithm was optimized for the specific setting needed in an application and for a given parameter setting. So, yes?
Markovian approach has not been used.
I mean, so it is certainly an interesting approach. I don't know of any work that has considered using it in this yes here.
It should mix rapidly because it's more or less.
I'm not aware of any paper that has done that yet. So there are some papers that tried to. So in n dimensions, you can try to use an approach like that by changing one coordinate at a time using this type of process. I think this perhaps has been tried but doesn't perform too well. But anyway, so here I'll be using just the one-dimensional problem, which is fairly simple. So is the perhaps Markov chain is over. This is a monotone function. It goes up and down. Yeah, it's a very nice function. So perhaps, Markov chain are too powerful, and you maybe pay some price for it, and there's no benefit. But it's certainly interesting to consider it as well. So, most algorithms and previous work was focused on specific applications because Gaussian sampling was often the bottleneck for fast implementation. So in order to make the application fast, the Gaussian sampling was targeted to the specific parameters of the application. But there are many different parameters that come into play depending on the application. So typically in applications like encryption, simple public key encryption, it is enough to sample this distribution with a fixed center. Even the origin is not even a non-zero point, and also the width S is fixed because you just need to generate these independent error terms, noise terms to be added to the LWE samples. And more complex primitives that make use of lattice sampling, they typically require algorithm that can take as input an arbitrary center C and an arbitrary width S. And these values, they are not even known in advance. They are known at runtime when you run your cryptographic primitive on a specific input. For example, when you get to send a message, then you are given C and S. And only then you know the parameters of the distribution. So this makes it harder to produce the randomness in advance, which is something that you could try think of doing, but it cannot be done in this setting. So the goal of our work is to come up with an algorithm that is generic. It can be applied for any value of the parameters. Still, it is efficient, and it is a single algorithm that can be implemented and optimized once and for all, so that all the other applications of lattice cryptography can use that as a black box. So let me briefly sketch two of the approaches I mentioned before to give a sense of what the problems are with those approaches, and also because I will be using these approaches as building blocks for the new algorithm. The rejection sampling approach is the following. First, you cut off the tails of the Gaussian distribution so that you restrict your distribution to a finite set. And after you have done that, you pick one of these points with uniformly random probability. So once you have picked this point, you have a point in the right range. Of course, it doesn't have the right distribution. It is uniform. So in order to make it Gaussian, you compute the Gaussian function at that point, and you accept your point with this much probability. After you pick one of these integers, you also pick a real number between 0 and 1. And then if it falls in this interval, then you reject the sample, and then you start the algorithm again. Now, the drawbacks of this approach is that it requires either to compute the exponential function online during the online phase of the algorithm, You can precompute the exponential function on all these points, but you can do this only if you know the center C and the parameter S in advance. So this is only possible for fixed parameters. And also, as if S gets large, then it requires a very, very large amount of storage. So the storage requirement to speed up the online phase of rejection sampling grows linearly with S. Also, rejection is something that somehow slows down the algorithm, because whenever you fall in this area, which for large S can have a substantial probability, then you lose your work and then you have to start over again. And wasting randomness is often one of the key steps, one of the critical parts of this algorithm. Generating the raw randomness, even the uniform one, can often be the most time-consuming part of this sampling algorithm. Randomness is a precious resource that you should be optimized for. So the inversion sampling is another standard approach where you compute the probabilities of all the points of interest. You combine them somehow into the interval 0 to 1. So you add them up to compute the cumulative distribution table. Then you pick a random real number in the interval 0 to 1, and then you check where it falls here. So this can be implemented using a table with as many entries as blocks in here, and then you can perform a binary search to find which block it belongs to. And again, so this is a fine approach. It works well for small parameters, but it is randomness inefficient. You need to generate, you cannot regenerate a real number, but you certainly need way more bits in R than the entropy of the output distribution. This can be somehow optimized by performing some form of lazy sampling. So you can only sample as many digits as you need to figure out what the final outcome is, and this makes the algorithm more randomness efficient. But it's still an algorithm that requires the precomputation of this table once you know all the parameters. So it doesn't have this generic property where you can precompute some randomness and then pass CNS at runtime. So Knut Yao, this is the last example. I will not describe how it works. It is some combination of this inversion sampling approach in a sort of recursive way with many tables. Knut and Yao, they build a tree structure that is traversed by tossing random bits. And so this approach is randomness optimal. It is also very efficient. It works very, very well in practice. But again, the storage requirement grows linearly with S. It is one of the most storage-hungry algorithms from this list when it comes to preprocessing. And it requires, as usual, to know the parameters in advance. So, but this is the approach that we ended up using as part of our algorithm for small parameters C and S. So as a summary, so previous approaches, they suffer from these deficiencies. They require knowledge of the parameters in advance, or they require the computation of the exponential function at runtime. And for large values of S, they become impractical because they typically have both a time and memory linear dependency on the standard deviation S. Yeah?
Basically, you're saying it's basically the same as inversion sampling, but you know, the first bit of the random real number I sampled from 0-1 already tells me what the sample is. I just output it. Otherwise, you know,
it's something slightly different than that. It builds a binary tree. It's not a full tree. And then you start picking random bits. So it is a specific way to organize these values into a tree. It is an optimal way to build this tree. And then you go down the paths picking random bits until you reach a leaf. So in this sense, you can think of it as something related to this. But it is the specific way that tree is constructed that is given the name Knut Yao. Is an optimal way where the amount of randomness that you end up using in each traversal is precisely the entropy of the distribution. So that gives optimality. Yes. So okay. So I didn't mention it. The most efficient algorithms they are subject to timing attacks because depending on which sample you output, you spend a different amount of time. And this is also one of the things that we tried to address in our new algorithm. So okay. So these are the problems with the new, old algorithm. So let me move to the new one. So the new one, in fact, is more than an algorithm in its own right, you can think of it as a reduction. What we did was to assume that you have a discrete Gaussian sampling algorithm for fixed and small values of C0 and S0. So fix these two values, C0 could even be 0, and S is a small number, think of it as 5 or 6, the bare minimum for the discrete Gaussian distribution to make sense. And you use this algorithm to generate a large number of samples from this fixed discrete Gaussian distribution. And then what our algorithm does is to take an arbitrary pair of parameters, S and C, and using these two values, it picks a combination of these samples that produces a value X that is the desired distribution. And the hope that we had was that, you can generate these smaller samples much faster because they are using fixed values of the parameters and small values as well. And so even if you end up using more than one sample to put together this X, in the end, the new algorithm can still be competitive with the ad hoc approaches that were optimized for single applications. So there are other advantages of this approach that, so I didn't tell you how to pick these coefficients, and we have two or three different algorithms that can be used for specific settings of the problem. So in the rest of the talk, I will describe the algorithms, but let me first tell you what are the advantages of this approach, at least from an intuitive point of view. So as I told you, since the parameters C and S are fixed for the basic samples, you don't need to build huge tables or huge trees. The requirements are the space requirements are small. The values are known in advance, so you can pre-compute these tables or these trees offline. And then you can use these tables to generate a large number of basic samples. And so these offer potential for hardware acceleration because the parameters are fixed. So once they are fixed and they are used by all the possible applications of lattice cryptography, you may consider having a dedicated piece of hardware that allows to produce these basic samples very fast. It can also be a key to achieve cost and time implementation, the security against timing attacks, as was mentioned by Vinod. So Knut Yao is subject to timing attacks. Also, other algorithms from the previous list are subject to timing attacks. So even if they are the fastest one, so you would like to use them. But here, you are generating not just one sample, but you are generating many of them, and you are generating them offline. So you can use amortization to make this part of the algorithm time independent without a big penalty. I mean, if you take Knut Yao to generate a single sample in order to make it time independent and avoid information leakage from time measurements, you need to pad the running time to the worst possible time of the algorithm, which is the depth of the tree, and you lose all the advantages of this Knut Yao tree structure. Here, you can use the fact that these are independent samples, so the expected running time to generate many of them is tightly concentrated around the average, and then you can make it time independent by adding only a small penalty to the running time to generate all of them in the aggregate. And the online phase is truly constant time. So the number of samples that get combined to generate the final output X is fixed. It doesn't depend on the randomness. So the more critical time-sensitive part of the application, that's very easy to implement both quickly and in constant time because it only requires to add up a few integers together.
So
when
you beat the
Yes.
So one, the linear coefficients of the linear combination, the Z's, they depend on X's themselves, or they are sort of, you know, they depend only on CNS?
They depend on that to some extent by any way. So I'm going to illustrate the algorithm now so it will be clear, yeah, how these numbers come from. And I think for the center, there may be some dependency, but it's something that still has a Markov type of property, a Martingale kind of property. So it doesn't affect the running time. And they are always small. We'll use the coefficients that are, you know, the size of these numbers. So the time that it takes to perform the multiplication of x1 by z1, that's also something that can be considered constant. So that's, yes.
So if you were only generating one x, would you still have constant time? Like, you have enough basic samples so that averaging?
Yeah, so this single x is using more than one xi. So, of course, the cost of making it constant time is higher if, the more basic samples you use and you put in your pool, before you make it constant time, the better. So even if you want to generate a single one, so you can make each generation constant time by keeping a pool of basic samples. So these samples and these distributions are independent from the application. So you can, instead of generating these values only when you need the X, you can do that offline. And also, you never need only a single x. So this x is usually an element of an n-dimensional vector. So typically, you need to generate at least 100 of this x. So multiply this by the number of samples which are used to compute each one of them. And we didn't implement this in constant time yet. In fact, getting a good, solid library implementing these algorithms in constant time is still something to be done. All I'm claiming now is that this new algorithm offers a good basis and good opportunities for constant time implementation at reasonable cost. But I don't have any hard numbers to give you. I think it should be optimal as well, or almost optimal. So the number of samples that we will use is logarithmic, but even I don't think you get a log n factor in the randomness, because these are samples from a Gaussian distribution with a smaller standard deviation, which has smaller entropy than the one that you are generating. So if you take all this randomness in the aggregate, the entropy should be fairly close to what you're getting in the end as the output. So let me sketch the algorithm. So I don't have a full description of the algorithm, but I'll try to give the idea. So there are two simple ways to... So let's first look at the problem of increasing S. You are given samples centered around the origin for small and fixed standard deviation. How can you generate something that is still Gaussian and has a larger standard deviation? Well, there are two simple things that you can do. One is to add many samples on the real numbers. If you add up many Gaussians together, you know that the result is still Gaussian. And so in the integers, these are approximately true as well, as long as these values come from a sufficiently large Gaussian of parameter at least 5 or 6. But the number of values that you need to add is quadratic in S. So the standard deviation of this sum grows with a square root of n. So this requires a very large number of samples that need to be added together. So it's not good, it's not efficient. So another thing that you can do, which is certainly randomness efficient, is to take a single sample and multiply it by a scaling factor, n. So that's very fast. This also, in terms of randomness, it is super optimal. It uses less entropy than it should. But the problem is that it doesn't produce a vector in Z. It's just scaling the distribution, so it's not really solving the problem. It is producing an integer, which is always a multiple of n, so it's not giving you what you want. So what we do is to...
That should be n,
it's not
right.
So,
n? You multiply by n, the standard deviation should just multiply by n, right?
Yes, this would grow by n, sorry. So this one is a typo, yes, of course. Yeah, good catch, thanks. So, but anyway, so what we'll do is to combine we will use both coefficients and sum together to get something better than this. And so what you can think of doing is, for example, to take the binary expansion of the standard deviation that you want to get and then add the corresponding sample. That also doesn't work. So it's a simple exercise to find that, it wouldn't work. So what we do is the following. So we start from two. So this is the basic step. You start from two samples that have standard deviation S. And so the key property that we use is that if you combine x0 and x1 with two integer coefficients that are relatively prime and they are smaller than S, then the sum, the corresponding linear combination, is distributed according to a Gaussian over the integers. So the fact that these two numbers are relatively prime avoids the multiplicative problem we saw before. And the standard deviation of the output is the square root of the sum of the squares of the input coefficients. Now, notice you can make these z0 and z1 as big as S. So the bigger is S, the bigger you can use your coefficients. So you can use this approach by picking bigger and bigger coefficients to get a very fast growth of the standard deviation. You can choose one of them to be order of S, the other one to be just Z minus 1 to make sure that they are relatively prime and at the same time to be as large as possible. And you can see that combining two samples allows you to square the standard deviation of your sample. So by using two samples with standard deviation S, you can get a new sample with standard deviation S square. And going back to your question about, so these factors, Z0 and Z1, can be chosen in this case in a way that is independent. They can be even hardwired as constants in your program. But in some setting, you may want to choose different numbers to optimize different properties or to fine-tune the standard deviation that you get as a final output. So by using different Z0 and Z1, so you may get a different standard deviation in the end.
But in any case, if I do constant multiplication or constant time, you don't care. I mean,
these are small enough numbers it wouldn't affect the in typical implementations, it wouldn't make any difference. So, and then we use this idea over and over. So we start from these samples that have small standard deviations, then you combine them two at a time with small coefficients to get larger sample. And as these samples get larger, we combine them with larger coefficients to get even larger samples. And if you repeat this log log S times, since every step the standard deviation is getting squared, you will get a Gaussian with a desired standard deviation. So even if you have an exponential growth here, you have a binary tree, so the depth is log log S, so the number of samples that you need is logarithmic in the output standard deviation, which gives some form of randomness optimality. Now, the basic idea of combining two samples together to increase the standard deviation is not new. It was already used in the Bliss to optimize the hardware implementation of the Bliss signature scheme. But in that setting, it was done only for a very specific value of the multipliers, 11 and 1 on the other side. And so the main insight in our work is that you can use this idea with different choices of Z and Z prime, which also gives better robustness against certain types of cache attacks, and you can also recurse. So you can repeat these through many levels, and the efficiency advantages of reducing S even further, as done in this work, more than compensates the need of using a larger number of basic samples. So this is the basic one of the key ideas of the other of our algorithm. The other one is how to sample around an arbitrary center C. So what I did so far works to sample a Gaussian distribution with large standard deviation around the origin. Now, what if I give you some other C, which is an arbitrary real number? Now, first of all, think of this input center as belonging to some very fine grid. I mean, real numbers do not exist anyway in computer science. Only mathematicians think they are real. And so think of this as coming from a very fine grid. So what we can do is to take the center, and then you can round it to a coarser grid. So you start from something that belongs to z over 2 to the k, and you can run it to a new center that belongs to z over 2 to the k minus 1. And then you can repeat this process again, and you run it to a center of the type z over 2 to the k minus 2. And you keep doing this k times until you end up with an integer. And if the way you round a point to a nearby point from the coarser grid is done not by rounding to the closest integer, which is either the integer itself or one of the two neighbors, you do it using a Gaussian distribution, and you choose it at random, so you perform some randomized rounding, then the final result will be will have a Gaussian distribution at the end. So this allows to reduce the problem of rounding around an arbitrary center C to the problem of rounding around a fixed center, for example, the origin. You can one way to do it is as follows. You first pick all these basic samples around zero, and you divide them into even numbers and odd numbers. So you build these two buckets of samples, those that belong to 2z and those that belong to 2z plus 1. Now, these samples are generated offline. This is what the basic sampler is used for. And notice all the parameters are fixed. The standard deviation S is fixed, and the center is also fixed. Then you are given a center C, which is expressed in binary. You take the least significant digit of the center, and you use this center to pick one of these two pools of values. So if CK is 0, then you pick a sample from here. If CK is 1, you pick a sample from there. And when you take this sample and you add it to the center, it will turn this digit into 0. It may also modify other digits from the center, but it will certainly make this one 0, so it will move you to a coarser grid. So this is how to use the basic samples to get rid of the center, to clear this center C one binary digit at a time. Of course, this algorithm can be generalized to other expansions rather than binary to achieve different trade-offs between memory and running time. But, so this works, and also it is interesting to note that the final distribution is Gaussian, and it is a fairly narrow Gaussian, because you combine it together. So this sample X, before being added to C, it gets divided by 2 to the k, so that you clear this digit. So what you are adding to your center is a collection of Gaussian samples, which are scaled by a geometric progression. So when you add all of them together, you will get a Gaussian sample, which is roughly the same standard deviation as that of the original samples, up to a small factor, say factor 2 from S, to compensate for the sum 1 over 2 to the I for all values of I. So here there is some dependency of the there is no dependency of the coefficient. The coefficient is always 1. But yes, so whether you pick it from here or from there depends on what you picked. But you can still prove that the final result is Gaussian, and it doesn't leak information about anything, and the running time is constant. So the operation that you are performing is just to pick unless you are keeping one group of sample in your RAM memory and the other one you save it on disk, which of course you wouldn't do, then so assuming that the access to these two groups is the same, this is easily implemented in constant time. So the only part that gets tricky to implement in constant time is the generation of the basic samples, but that can be amortized and made constant time in the aggregate. Okay, so there are various extensions and optimizations. Yes,
So the first algorithm, it increases the
standard deviation, right? From S to S squared. So if I wanted to sample a discrete Gaussian with the bare minimum standard deviation, like the smoothing parameter, this won't work. It's slightly bigger than the smoothing parameter.
It's going to be slightly bigger than that. Yeah. And also for this center, yes. So if you just want to get the smallest possible, and the problem you are trying to address is how to use an arbitrary center. So this is the price that you pay. It's a sum. It's not even 2, because you need to square these numbers before you add them up. So it is the sum of the powers of 1 over 4. So, but yeah, it's a fairly small number. So it's slightly bigger, but only by a little bit.
This guy, the first algorithm where you...
but the one you only need it if you want to increase the standard deviation. So this is the...
I see what you mean.
So if you want... You wouldn't use this
one. If I wanted to use the smallest standard deviation, I would just pick something from the from my memory and use the second algorithm.
Yeah. This one is only used to. In fact, this one is what you would use if you wanted to sample around zero, but with large standard deviation.
Yes.
If you wanted to sample with large standard deviation but around an arbitrary center, you can do something that is even better than running first this and then the other one. What you can do is to take your center. Then you add a real Gaussian sample of whatever standard deviation you want. And since this is a real number, you can generate this and scale it by multiplication. And you can so you can perturb the center before running this. And then you round this center, which is not an integer, to an integer. So you can use this for Gaussian rounding and take care of increasing the standard deviation using just real Gaussian sampling techniques.
In the first algorithm, right?
Yeah.
Is it exactly true that the combination has a distribution, or the distribution is approximately?
It's approximately. It's approximate, yes.
Number one. Second question is, your z's don't depend on the x's.
They don't, yes.
They're
in there. So in that case, yeah, they're also
both
here.
Cases.
In both cases. Yeah, here they're always one, and there they're just this... fixed coefficients. So I take back what I said. I told you there might be some dependency just to be safe before, but yes, you're right. There is no dependency at all. No. Okay, so there are various optimizations that we considered, but I will not talk about them except for this last one. So when it comes to using floating point numbers to approximate probabilities, a recurring problem is how much precision do you need to use in order to get good security? And we developed some techniques to improve on that front. ML is not the machine learning or the programming. I'll tell you in a moment. But before moving to that last issue, let me just show a couple of pictures about performance. So in the paper, there are many more graphs. And this is not an optimized implementation. It's just a quick prototype implementation that we wrote to compare our algorithm that uses multiple samples to the previous ones. And so this is our algorithm. So you can see that today, so it offers a time memory trade-off where by using more memory, you can generate more samples. The number of samples that you generate is measured in the order of millions of samples per second, which is pretty good. And it works for arbitrary center. And so the only other algorithm that offered a time memory trade-off in this setting is the discrete Ziegurat algorithm. But the one, it flattens pretty early on. And if you have even just a couple of kilobytes of memory, you can already match the performance of the other algorithms, or even improve it using our new reduction approach. And so the other approaches do not require knowing CNS in advance. So the main advantage of the new algorithm is not the improved speed, is the fact that you don't need to know S and C ahead of time. And so here we are comparing our algorithm with Kearney's algorithm, which is this variant on von Neumann sampling algorithm. And so Kearney algorithm has a dependency on the performance of Kearney degrades with the standard deviation, while if our algorithm is used the way I just mentioned, you first add a real noise to increase the standard deviation, and then you perform the randomized Gaussian rounding, then there is no dependence at all on the standard deviation. So you can see from our experiments that here there is no dependency at all on S. Okay, so approximate sampling. So these basic samples are not going to have exact Gaussian distribution. That's too expensive to produce. And that's also irrelevant because the combination process is going to be also approximate. So even if you start from exact Gaussian samples, the output is not going to be exactly Gaussian. But you want it to be very close to Gaussian. You want to be able that by using these approximations, you are not losing bits of security. And so the question is, how does the approximation of the X size affect the approximation of the final output? And how to analyze that and how to optimize that. Now, the standard method used in cryptography to deal with this type of issues is the statistical distance or variation distance. So given two distributions, you look at the area that is between the two envelopes. And if you use the statistical distance, if you wanted to achieve k bits of security, you need to make the statistical distance at most 2 to the minus k, which when using floating point numbers, it pretty much translates into the need of using floating point numbers with k bits of precision. So if you use a standard 53-bit floating point numbers, you are going to get only 50. You cannot get more than 53 bits of security, at least from the analysis, which is inadequate for cryptographic applications. So the question is, do you need to go to arbitrary precision floating point numbers to get high levels of security, say 100 or 200 bits of security, or you can get away with a standard hardware floating point? And so we developed a method that can be used to achieve this in the analysis. Now, one of the useful features of statistical distance is that, as the name suggests, it is a distance function. So that makes it convenient to use. It is symmetric. It satisfies the triangle inequality. It satisfies also subadditivity. And that's why statistical distance is so widely used in cryptography. However, it's not the best tool to use when it comes to achieving strong results. So stronger tools have been considered and used already in a number of papers in lattice cryptography, primarily the KL divergence, or more generally the Rényi divergence, which is parametrized by a value A. And KL divergence is a special case when the parameter is set to 2. Now, this is the definition of the KL divergence. Unless you are working with the KL divergence every day, it's a much harder formula to remember. It is also not symmetric with respect to X and Y. And more importantly, does not satisfy triangle inequality. So when you use these techniques in a complex cryptographic protocol that works through a sequence of hybrid arguments, then working with a KL divergence gets quite tricky. So on the other hand, it satisfies a certain Pythagorean probability preservation property, which essentially tells you that when you take many samples together, then the distance grows with a square root of the number of samples that you are considering. And that's key to improve the analysis of cryptographic algorithms. But it is harder to use. Until now, this was considered pretty much the price to get this tighter analysis. So what we did was, we found a new way to define the distance between two distributions, which is fairly simple. It is essentially just the max norm between two vectors, the two vectors of probabilities. But before doing that, you take the logarithm of the probabilities. So you apply the logarithm function to the probabilities, and then you take the maximum distance. That's why we called it ML. It stands for max log distance. And so this, it immediately inherits the distance properties from the max. So this is the L infinity norm between f of x and f of y. So it will be trivially symmetric and satisfy the triangle inequality. But it also satisfies subadditivity. This is something that needs to be proved. But more interestingly, it gives the Pythagorean probability preservation that is key to get in a tight analysis. And using this, it is possible to show that 53 bits of precisions are enough to get 100 or more bits of security. In fact, if you have a bounded number of samples, you can do even better. You can show that the number of bits of security is even more than that, like 200. So this is what you get if you put no bound on the running time of the adversary.
It's close to zero. Log
with -. So here, so you apply these when so the two distributions need to have the same support. Otherwise, it's not even defined. And yes, so you need to truncate the tail, get rid of the tail. So yes. So in our analysis, we combine it also with the statistical distance by first using the statistical distance to get rid of the tails. But there is no penalty. That's not where you suffer the penalty in the analysis. And once you do that, you apply this tool. So this issue is also something that comes up here when using the divergences rather than the distance.
But the penalty you get is that the samples you produce are close to the Gaussian samples in this distance.
No. So this Pythagorean probability essentially says that if this quantity is small, then the security of the cryptographic application is twice as good. So it's... Let me tell you what it is. But before that, let me. So can I take a few more minutes to be here? Okay. So we started late. Okay. So it's plus I had another half an hour that I was promised before coming here, and I was told that usually these talks are 1 hour and a half. So anyway, so I'll take only just 5 more minutes. Okay. So then, so first, so this quantity is closely related to other standard quantities. The most interesting one for our applications is the relative error. And the reason is that relative error is exactly the measure of quality of floating point numbers. That's exactly what a floating point number is. So if you're using a floating, so you can show that the ML distance and the relative error are essentially the same. So this is equality up to lower order terms, and this is the exact form of the upper and lower bounds on this quantity. So if you're using 53 bits floating point numbers, you know that the ML distance is 53 bits. And it is also related to the Rényi divergence of order infinity. You can think of it as symmetrization of Rényi infinity divergence, which once you do that, it becomes a distance. And it was recently brought up to our attention by Ilya Mironov that this definition that we gave is also closely related to the differential privacy. So in differential privacy, you have a definition of the form and the probability of x is at most e to the epsilon probability of y, where x and y are two databases that differ only at one point. And if you just rewrite this, it is exactly bound on the difference between the logarithms of the probabilities. What is there to read into this relation? We still do not know, but it is certainly nice to observe that the definition is not something that is completely new. It's something that is fairly close to what was used before in a number of places. Now, so this illustrates what you get out of using ML distance. What we can prove from this is that, so if you have a cryptographic application, think of this as a generic definition where security is defined as T over P, where T is the running time of the adversary, P is the success probability of the attack, and T over P, we think of it, the logarithm of T over P, we take it as the number of bits of security of the cryptographic primitive. Now, so this is a definition that works well for search problems. It doesn't quite work for decision problems. So for decision problems, it's not clear how this should be defined. But for search problem, this is a good definition of bit security, and we can prove that. So if you use the statistical distance, the standard application of statistical distance shows that if S of X, where S is a cryptographic scheme and X is a probability distribution, provides k bits of security, and then you replace x with some other distribution y that is within statistical distance 2 to the minus k, then the output also has k almost k bits of security. And using the ML distance, we can show that if x and y are within ML distance 2 to the minus k over 2, so this is enough to preserve k bits of security. So here in the analysis, we lose 3 bits of security rather than 1, and I'm pretty sure that this can be optimized. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. It's not this constant that makes that difference. So, and this is true for not just for applications that use a single sample. So S of X is a cryptographic application that can draw any number of samples from the distribution X. So in particular, it can be used in our sampler when it is put inside the bigger sampler. So that tells you the number of bits of precisions that need to be used in the core building Knut Yao sampler or Kearney sampler, which is used to generate the basic samples. So, okay, so this concludes my talk. So as a summary, we introduced this new algorithm or reduction to solve the general Gaussian sampling problem, which is at least as efficient as previous approaches, but it has the advantage of generality and doesn't need values to be known in advance. And this opens up the door to all sort of implementation in hardware and software and achieving resistance against timing attacks, though that's something that is still yet to be done. So what we did so far is to develop the analytical tools to design the algorithm. Thank you for your attention.
Any more questions?
So, okay, I have 2 questions. If we can use 53-bit precision floating point for more than 100-bit security in the sense of max low distance, then so, by combining the theorem, we can guarantee more than 200 bits of cryptographic system.
Yeah. So that can be done if the number of samples is bounded. So this factor 2 is what you get in the unbounded sample case. But if you put a bound on the number of samples, it is possible to go beyond a factor 2. And you can get over 200.
I don't understand why we really need recursion algorithm when we sample Gaussian. I mean, if each of the partial tree is linear combination of xi, then the final result is again the linear combination of these xi. Mm-hmm. So if we pre-compute the coefficient of xi,
So the Knut Yao is used to generate this exercise. So you're asking why don't I precompute it? Because you need this, so you may need more and more. So how many of these you need depends on the application. Think of a signature scheme. You are given a message to sign, and once you're given this message, you are going to use some of these values. So the more messages you sign, the more values you will need. So you can precompute some of them. This can be useful to amortize the running time and achieve security against timing attacks. But the more messages you sign, you will exhaust the pre-computed samples, and then you will need to run some algorithm to sample them. But it is something that can be done before knowing the message to be signed or before knowing the input to the cryptographic application. So in that sense, yes, they can be pre-computed.
You showed a connection between ML distance to the security, right? The k over 2.
Yeah.
For search problems.
Yeah.
Does it also hold for, does a similar statement also hold for decision, CPA security for?
Okay, so for decision problems like CPA security, it's not clear what the right definition of k-bits of security should be. So what does k-bit mean? And so I think that the right definition is that you should take epsilon square. So in which case, it holds just by definition that it double. It seems kind of cheating, but we wouldn't be the first people to suggest this. So this is something that is already suggested in the Hill paper, the one-way function. So in order to get tight reductions, they suggest that, this could be a good way to define. I mean, it's a theoretical paper.
Epsilon is the advantage.
Okay. So yeah, yeah. So you should. So so if epsilon is the advantage, then the bit one possible definition of bit security could be t over logarithm of t over epsilon square. So this is a candidate definition, which I like, because if you just take the definition, then you get this factor two improvement for decision problems as well. But this is something that requires more investigation before claiming that that's the right definition of bit security. There is really no consensus within the cryptographic community about what is bit security for decision problems. For such problems, I think that it is pretty much established. But for decision problems, I think that it's not clear at all.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'll be around here also for the later. If I'm happy to talk after that. Yeah. Bye.
Short question: like floating point arithmetic takes variable time on modern processors. So is that factored into your claim about constant time, or?
Yeah, so first, it does take variable time, but it shouldn't. There are many people in security arguing that that's a design flaw. But no, in this in this specific context of our application, we are not using a floating point. We are not using exponential functions or anything. And the floating point arithmetic, the way it is used, I think it shouldn't make any difference. I think the algorithms can be implemented in fixed point arithmetic very easily, without losing anything. You always know how many bits of precision you're using at every step. So yeah, before claiming that any implementation is resistant against timing attacks, all of these issues need to be analyzed carefully. And we didn't do that. And we are not even in the process of doing it. There are many open problems on the way to getting a real constant time implementation. This is just a starting point.
Let's thank Daniel again.